Hello and welcome to Talking Trading. I'm Caroline Stephen. It's great to have your company. Today we have a technological expose. Silicon Valley is a unique place on Earth. San Francisco is the birthplace of the hippie movement and it's the home of the tech revolution. Australian entrepreneur Elias Vezzani's made headlines around the United States and Australia 2 weeks ago when Republican presidential candidate Paul Rand dropped in unexpectedly to his startup house headquarters in the Valley. Today we speak to Elias about the culture of Silicon Valley and the ecosystem where anything is possible. But first up, we have Chris Tate with a history of tech stocks and their performance over the last 20 years. ZT, what's the association between tech stocks and the NASDAQ?
Well, it's one of those questions that you first need a bit of clarification. When I was at high school, I was forever being told to define my terms, and it's a lesson that was repeated endlessly in my ear whilst I was at university. There's actually two NASDAQs that people refer to. There is the NASDAQ Composite. The NASDAQ Composite comprises every stock listed on the NASDAQ exchange. So in that respect, it's analogous to the NYSE Composite. It's a giant broad-based index with thousands of stocks, and they comprise anything from airlines to real estate, to biotech, to financial, to whatever. When people are referring to the notion of technology-based stocks in the NASDAQ, more appropriately, they're referring to the NASDAQ 100, which in one of those quirks doesn't contain 100 stocks, but actually 107. It's where you have the Apples, the Adobes, the Broadcoms. That's the more appropriate one that people who are mad keen on technology stocks should actually be looking at.
When and what was the dot-com bubble?
The bubble itself spans about 97 to 2000. And it was that time when there was, call it mania. And as such, it ranks alongside the South Sea bubble, the Dutch tulip boom, the Roaring Twenties, the period of excess in the mid-1980s. So it fits in with that. People just threw money at anything they vaguely thought was a technology stock. And most of these technology stocks were two pimply-faced dweebs in cardigans working from a garage in their parents' house. And to give you some idea of how silly it was, in 1999, there were some 457 IPOs, of which 117 doubled on the first day. In 2001, that number had collapsed to 76 after the tech wreck. So it was this bizarre period whereby if you effectively wanted to double your share price, you would change your company name and you'd put the prefix E in front of it, or you'd put .com at the end, and the valuation would leap overnight.
When and what was the tech wreck?
The tech wreck was when the music ended and everybody woke up and went, oh God, what have we done? All periods of mania end with a bust. They never end smoothly. It's never a gentle landing. At the end of these booms, your parachute never opens and you do go splat into the ground. And so what happened one day was everybody woke up and went, oh dear God, this is stupid. And the paradigm shifted overnight. And the NASDAQ 100 eventually lost about 83% of its value. And it still hasn't recovered to this day. It's nearly back to where it was, to its all-time high. But it's not back to that level yet.
Okay, so let's look at how some of the major tech stocks are performing now. What about Facebook, Google, Apple?
There's probably two ways to look at this. If you look back in time, and let's look initially at the survivors of the tech wreck. Before the tech wreck, there were obviously stocks like Microsoft and Apple and the like, and these had been around for quite a while. The big kid on the block post the tech wreck is Apple. Apple's performance has just killed everybody. Intriguingly, though, you know, the survivors, Amazon and eBay, if you had been involved in those, they've done exceptionally well. I think when Amazon's price collapsed to $7 and then rebounded to $400. But if we look at the likes of, you know, the Googles, the Facebooks, and again, you know, the Apples, they tend to have been, over the past particularly year, fairly standoutish in their performance. I think what we're looking at, Facebook's up 30% for year to date. Apple's up nearly 50% year to date. The difference now, this is the thing, there is a pivot shift. We still have, I think, a mini tech boom going on. but we're not actually seeing it because it's a private boom. We've now got all these odd means of funding like Kickstarter campaigns and the like, and venture capitalists. So the venture capitalists are burning money on companies that are not coming to market. So we're not actually getting to see them. Last year in the US, only 275 IPOs. So they're not bringing these companies to market. And the odd thing now is, in the tech boom, you know, in this dot-com mania, very few of these companies actually had a business. They didn't actually do anything. They thought they were going to do something, and they might have had what was a very good idea, but they didn't have a business. And if you look at the S&P 500's largest companies in terms of their cash holdings, this is the amount of money they got in the bank, you do see things like Apple, Microsoft, Google, iCash, Verizon. They actually have a business with cash now.
Let's look at the tech DAX, which is performing so well at the moment. Why is that?
This is an intriguing little thing. If you look at the performance of the tech DAX at present, if you compare it to the DAX itself, it's only in the past few weeks that you've actually got this outperformance. If you look at Europe, Europe's very, very interesting when it comes to emerging technologies, because the only success story they've ever had, or in terms of IT, is SAP out of Germany. They haven't produced a Facebook, they haven't produced an Apple, they haven't produced an Amazon, which is unusual because both in terms of the amount of money that is awash, particularly in Germany, and the talent base they have. And I think what you're seeing there is simply, we have money, we need to put it somewhere. And so you're seeing a hot money flush more than anything else.
Chris Tate, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Caroline.
Knowing which sector is hot and which is not is essential. Check out the hot and cold menu item on tradinggame.com.au for your free weekly fix.
With the presidential elections gearing up in the USA, Republican Senator Paul Rand visited Startup House in the Silicon Valley 2 weeks ago in a bid to woo Gen X and Gen Y voters. As the Australian Financial Review reported, Rand answered an online challenge from Startup House founder, Australian entrepreneur Elias Bezanis. Elias is also the founder of Startup Bus, a three-day competition where buspreneurs compete to conceive of the best tech startup idea. Startup Bus is active in five continents, in North and South America, Europe, Africa, and Australia, and it receives extensive press coverage from CNN, BBC, and national newspapers. Today we speak to Elias Bezanis on the entrepreneurial culture of Silicon Valley and on the ecosystem where anything is possible. Elias Bezanis, hello and welcome to Talking Trading.
Hello, how you doing?
Elias, I'd like to start off by asking about the entrepreneurial spirit of Silicon Valley. How would you describe it?
One thing that you notice when you move here is no one's from here. I think I've only met 10 people from San Francisco in the 5 years that I've been here. So everyone is not so much so many foreigners, although there's a lot of us from outside of America. It's just because it's hard to get a visa. But even a lot of Americans coming from all around America. So that creates this, it's a very transient city, and it's also got this culture of people that are always these fresh ideas and this fresh energy. One thing that a mentor said to me, which I have to say is very true, is you move over here and you see all these smart people. That's why you move over here. And then you start talking to them, you get to know them, and then you realize they're not much smarter than you. And then you start thinking, well, if they're doing that, then I can do that. And then what happens is you've just got this almost like, I wouldn't say this competitive culture, but because everyone is doing such amazing things, you almost feel like what you're doing is boring and you need to push yourself. So everyone here is working on something. You've got your day job, you've got your night job, and you've got like a side project that you're doing. So everyone is kind of working on multiple things at the same time, and it's just part of the culture here. The whole, it's a lifestyle, I think, being in the startup world. And so, you know, it's you know, some of the best deals that you make are actually over alcohol at social events. And actually all my investors are people that I've partied with in Vegas and then happened to help me out when I needed them. So it's very much intertwined. It's an ecosystem really built around that. Everyone from the lawyers to the architects to the brokers, for example.
Is everyone so it's, passionate yeah. about what they do? There's a lot of passion.
Yeah, there is a lot of passion, and you find it's almost very idealistic here as well. So because of San Francisco's origins as like the hippie, where the hippie movement started,
hippie capital,
I think you know, they call California the left coast, and it's a big bastion of like liberalism. tourism here, and you see it also in a lot of the silly city politics. But what happens is it's actually attracting those types of people, and that's now infiltrating in the tech ecosystem. So a lot of the things that you see in Google's products, for example, on Facebook, the whole open culture that Facebook pushes is actually a very much a Bay Area culture that started before the tech industry started here.
What do you mean?
Bay Area meaning hippies started here, and it's a hippie culture here.
So what's Facebook pushing that is part of?
So Facebook, for example, has a view that all your information should be public. You shouldn't have private information. So the default settings on Facebook is public, and Mark Zuckerberg's constantly gone on record when they're releasing new features where the default is public. And it has been a huge cultural change that we now are used to, but I remember 5-10 years ago, there was huge outcry around that. Like when Google introduced Gmail and we had these ads automatically scan our emails, now we don't even think twice about it. So that's an example of the open culture that I think is very heavily influenced by the Bay Area San Francisco culture, which is very open in itself.
How prevalent is people thinking big over there? Because here in Australia, we tend to be more bootstrapped. What's the comparison like?
Big difference about Silicon Valley. It's a unique place in the world. Like I do business all around the place. You know, like I'm going to New York this Friday, and I was in Europe 3 weeks ago. So I'm talking to tech ecosystems all around the world, as well as Australia that I'm very heavily linked to. And I find Silicon Valley is just—it's a unique thing. Nothing compares to it, and nothing will be a Silicon Valley. And one of the things that makes it so different is the money that exists here. And we're not just talking about like a bunch of old money that is here. We're talking about professional investors who make a job at trying to bet revolutionary ideas and disruptive ideas. And so the ideas here are not so much how much revenue can I make so I can pay my rent, which is what everyone in Australia does because there isn't that funding market. What they do here is like, how can I build an app that's going to get 1 million users so that I can then raise funding and grow that into a $1 billion business? So you've got this mentality about how can you create users and growth versus sort of revenue and growth, which is a lot harder to do. And so the culture here is a lot more creative because you're not sort of constrained by the idea of having to generate revenue straight away. Your ideas are a lot more open. And because I think fundamentally all big ideas are disruptive. They're not obvious. So, for example, Airbnb, I still don't understand how that is a business. I don't understand how people let the – and I've been an Airbnb host. Like I don't know why I do it, like why I allowed people into my home and I'm making money out of it. So in retrospect, it makes sense. Just like Uber, it makes sense. But at the time, if someone would have pitched those ideas to me, I would have said it was stupid. And that's the thing about all disruptive ideas. So it is like this hotbed of it's like this constant petri dish of experiments occurring. And what you see in the news are the stuff that's made it. But there's another 1,000 failed experiments and haven't made it. And the people that worked on that then got a new job at a next startup, which might be the next big thing.
Okay, so what do you see the people who have made it? What is distinctive about them?
So I think Silicon Valley has two types of people. You've got the people that have their heads down and work, and you've got then the socialites that are always in the media. I think a mistake people make, and also people living here, is they use the media as a barometer of what success is. A lot of the people that are in the media are actually just manipulating the journalists, and they're not actual real success. And I see a lot of people that generate these runs on the board that actually aren't runs on the board. Like they got acquired, but it's an acquisition for the talent. You know, it's a bit like buying a house and buying expensive furniture, and then you sell the furniture and you say the house you built around the furniture is valuable, but it's actually just the furniture that they bought. So that's to me what a talent acquisition is, and that's very common in Silicon Valley. But I think the really successful people here, you don't hear about them, and they're the ones that are quietly building companies after companies. So, you know, a lot of my network of Aussie entrepreneurs here are not very good with the media. They're media shy, but they're guys that are some of the best entrepreneurs in Australia. So that's, I think, one big thing that I've noticed. But there's a lot of other things that I think that makes an entrepreneur successful. But
do you feel like you're in the ideas and creative capital of the world?
Yeah, that's a pretty bold statement to make. But, yeah, I think so. I think tech is the new oil in the world. And what I mean by that, tech is an industry like the oil industry, but it's also producing something that impacts every other industry, just like oil is. And just like we have financial centers like in Sydney, like in New York and London and Frankfurt, we're now going to see tech centers. And to prove this, if you go to Berlin or you go to New York or you go to London, and I'm even seeing this in Sydney, you're seeing office rents now advertising high tech. I remember being in Sydney just a few months ago and seeing how there was like office space for high tech, but just by Pyrmont. The same thing's happening in Pyrmont, in Berlin, and a tenth of all the leases that are occurring in London is the same thing. New York, which is the center for banking, fashion, and media, there is a huge renaissance happening right now for startups. There's a company called WeWork that does co-working spaces. There's 13 of them in New York. So it's not the tech capital of the world, but there's 13 of these WeWorks. So, and New York's got the mayors are really progressive there, and I think they're going to open up a new campus there for one of the major universities. So I expect New York to redefine itself in the next decade, and we'll be considering it alongside being a banking capital, a technology capital. So I think tech is now spreading across the world, but I do think Silicon Valley is unique, and I don't think anyone's ever going to surpass Silicon Valley just because of its unique background and history.
So you run Startup Bus, which is active on four continents across the world. When you are undergoing your competition on Startup Bus, do you notice a difference in the psyches between each culture?
Oh, ridiculously. We just finished doing Startup Bus Europe, and ignoring the participants, the actual organizing team of 30 people that we had on it, the differences between the different countries. Like, I can understand why Europe had two world wars just based on the way people are collaborating. Like, you've got, like, the Germans are amazing at spreadsheets. Phenomenal what they can do with functions and formulas, things that as a trained accountant, I don't even know how to do. And then you have, like, the more Mediterranean cultures, like the Greeks, the Spanish, and the Italians, who just do their own thing and are just about partying all the time. And trying to get everyone away. And then you've got the English, who are just, like, anal. And it's funny how they operate. So seeing, like, the organizing team together that almost broke down into a world war in itself just made me wonder, like, how the hell we even pulled off the event. But in terms of culture, I think there's a huge difference. And I've seen this, and because we've run, like, up to 60 buses now around the world, I've seen directly the outputs of each one. So, for example, you know, I one thing I've noticed that a lot of people don't know is Mexico has some of the best talent in the world. And consistently, Mexico is outperforming every other tech region in the U.S., and Startup Bus is big in Mexico because for years the media has been talking about drugs, but Startup Bus made national attention because suddenly now the news media had a story that was positive for the economy. So what you're seeing is Startup Bus in Mexico is like a way to prove themselves against the North Americans, which includes the Canadians as well as America. So Startup Bus as a competition, we've designed it in a way to not sort of develop people, but we're also showcasing the tech ecosystems in the world. And it's like this common platform where everyone gets on the same competition and we see what they produce. And the differences couldn't be more stark, but it's also why we do this. We're trying to sort of bridge that gap and export that Silicon Valley culture around the world.
So how does Australia look?
Australia has changed a lot in the last 5 years since I've been away. I think a really positive thing that's happening with Australia, and, you know, I'm one of them, we're on these E3 visas, which we can thank Johnny Howard. That was like a thank you for the Iraq war that was attached to the free trade agreement that we had. And what that's enabling is labor mobility. So people like myself can easily get a visa and create a business here. And we're also helping the Australians back in Australia through our relationships. So what I think is the E3 visa and the respect that America has for Australia is actually allowing the Australian economy to benefit because of the free-flowing information and money that's occurring. So one of my investors, who's an Australian entrepreneur, just moved back to Sydney. He's all his Silicon Valley knowledge, networks, and money that he made here, he's now going to be bringing that to Sydney. And that's another example of what I mean. Like, in the long term, I really think Australia is benefiting by being allied so close to America. So I think Australia is just like the rest of the world, and in fact is even more removed, but because of that relationship with the US, it's actually getting ahead of other countries.
Okay, so as an entrepreneur, what's one thing you've learnt in your success?
So one thing I've learned is be a cockroach.
What's that?
And what that means is never give up. So cockroaches and apparently other animals like scorpions can survive a nuclear attack. And it's not over until you are kicking and screaming on the floor and you can no longer kick and scream and breathe. And that's, to me, the only excuse you have when you need to give up. There, like a year and a half ago, I was about to declare bankruptcy. And I realized this on the Friday afternoon and was depressed. Went to Vegas that weekend to have a think about it and came back on the Monday and then decided, you know what, I'm going to give this a go and roll the dice. Long story short, in the next week, I raised 150 grand, even though I never raised investment before in my life, which kept me going for a few more months. And these are the same people that have told me they wouldn't invest in my business. So that's an example that I have in most recently where I had every reason to give up, but I didn't. And because I was a cockroach, I've survived and I'm still standing today.
What do you love about what you do?
The freedom. So I've been an employee for 7 years of my life, and I've been a full-time entrepreneur now for 2.5 years, even though I've been running my business for 5 years. And even though I am drawing a wage that is far less than what I ever made, including at the peak of my earnings, which was when I was a venture capitalist, I'm a lot happier because of the freedom I have. You know, I can work from home in my underwear. You know, it's like, doesn't really matter. I don't have to sort of explain myself to anyone. And I can just jot off to another country without telling anyone. And I actually give that same freedom to my employees. And that's why they're so happy, even though they're not getting paid, say, as much as working at Google where they did before. And what I've realized is that freedom dynamic is actually almost as valuable than pay itself. And people really value that. And so I only know that as an employee myself. And now as an entrepreneur that has even more freedom. I mean, the negative is the risk. And, you know, I've lost my hair just in the last 2 years of the stuff I've had to go through. But at the same time, I wouldn't give it up on the world. And my worst case scenario is that I have to get another job, to be honest. That's what scares me more than bankruptcy.
Elias Bazanis, it was a delight speaking with you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And that's all we have for you today, guys. Stay tuned next week for our resident psychologist, Simone Miller, on worthiness and success. I'm Caroline Stephen, and on behalf of the team here, thanks for your company. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to talkingtrading.com.au with Caroline Stephen. Make sure you are subscribed to this website to receive the very latest market views, commentary, and expert opinion. Tune in next week as we've got a bumper show planned. Bye for now.
The views represented on Talking Trading are general in nature and do not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Before acting on any of the information, consider its appropriateness in regard to your own situation.